Good morning.
Good morning.
So today I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva vow. This is a really important part of our practice, and it fits in with everything we've been talking about so far, which I'm going to review briefly. Okay. So what we've talked about so far is dependent co-arising in emptiness, what's called emptiness, and no self, I am Buddha nature. So in a nutshell, emptiness and dependent co-arising are like two sides of the same coin. Emptiness means everything is empty of separation. If you look for some fixed essential essence of something, you won't find it. What you'll find is that everything is connected to everything else. That everything is empty of isolation. It's not isolated. It's not permanent. It's not separate. It's connected, always connected. And it's that connection that is the most deep truth about our reality. That everything arises with everything else. So if you look at a glass, it looks permanent and fixed, but actually glass is always moving. It's just very, 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 very slowly. It was made by someone somewhere. It comes from the earth. So when you see this glass, you can see the earth, the sky, you can see all that went into, all the people that touched this, the person that designed it. So when you look at something that you think is a separate thing, if you look at it carefully, you will see that it's actually made up of many elements, so many that we could never even discover them all. It's endless. So that means that it's empty of a separate, isolated, fixed definition or self. And this dynamic arising, intimate, always related arising, is dependent co-arising. It means there's nothing that isn't dependent on something else. And this is true for us too. So if we look inside ourselves, what we'll see is that we are always in relationship with everything else. And that we're always changing. It's impermanent. Things are always changing. So we see that as we age. We see that as we interact with other people. I was reading a little article in the newspaper this morning about a man who was in a concentration camp in Nazi Germany. And an American soldier came when they were liberated and was kind to him and gave him a little handkerchief. And he kept that handkerchief. And it totally transformed his life. So we're not usually in those kind of dramatic circumstances, you know. But we're always changed by what we interact with, by the choices that we make, by the people that we are with, by circumstances that we can't control. But we always have the ability to work with our own minds and hearts. That's our practice. So these truths of emptiness, no self, dependent co-arising, are ways of talking about the possibility that we have within our reality. And then the term Buddha nature is a positive language to speak about all that. It's not an essence. It's about potential. And it's about goodness. And it's about realization. It's about what we discover when we discover the truth of emptiness, when we discover the intimacy and the relationality of everything. We call this Buddha nature. We call this, another word is thusness. Thusness. The reality of this potent moment. And it's very practical, very real, very down to earth. And it is what we are. That's what we are. So this is not an essence. It's really important. When we hear Buddha nature, we tend to think of an essence or a fixed center. But according to the teachings, if we look carefully, we will not find that fixed, eternal essence. But what we find is this dynamic reality that is liberative. When we see this, we're liberated. As our suffering comes from, not pain, but suffering comes from not seeing clearly, not knowing who we and all beings are. So part of the consequence of seeing this way is that we, our hearts open, that we are transformed. And one of the ways that we talk about this in our tradition is about the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva, Bodhi means enlightenment. Means awakening. And sattva means being. So a bodhisattva is an enlightenment being, an enlightening being, a being who's dedicated to waking up for the benefit of everyone. So we do this practice of realizing who we are and liberating ourselves from suffering in order to be able to liberate all from suffering. And the thing that's interesting about that is, of course, if we are no different than everybody else, and that's what we see when we see clearly, of course we're going to be moved and we're going to respond to others. So our intention is what's most important. In Soto Zen, we say, we're not liberated from the world, we're liberated to the world. We're liberated to reality. We're liberated to acting for the benefit of all. And we touch a kind of strength and energy and vigor when we do this. The Bodhisattva is not a wimp. The Bodhisattva is someone who has energy and dedication, and finds energy and dedication in being alive to the intimacy and the dependent co-arising of our world. One way of talking about the Bodhisattva is as an object of reverence. So we have the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Probably have heard of Canon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Kuan Yin, kind of the mother of mercy. And she's right over there. She's right there. This, when we think about the kind of embodiment or the total expression of this compassion, we think of Canon, we think of Kuan Yin, called the hearer of the cries of the world. She or he who hears the cries of the world and responds. Another image of Canon is with many, many, many hands and arms. There's a contemporary artist named Mayumi Oda who has one in which every hand has like a frying pan or bread, a rolling pin or a pan or, the idea is that the heart of compassion responds in a very practical way. Making bread, writing something. I suppose it could have a mouse in one hand, for computer use or whatever. The point is that we venerate, we make offerings to, we care for, we revere this emblematic nature, this beauty of great compassion. So that's one way of thinking about the Bodhisattva, is as a figure that we attend to and are inspired by. However you think of it, you know, or you could think of a great person who is a Bodhisattva, for Nelson Mandela, for example, or Desmond Tutu, or Mother Teresa, or Dalai Lama. We look at people and we say, ah, a great Bodhisattva in the world. How they do it. So that's one way that we think of the Bodhisattva. But another way is that we are a Bodhisattva in the world. That by living this way, we enact Bodhisattva vow in our daily life. So this Bodhisattva vow, we say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are endless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. So there's different ways to translate this, but I think you get the feeling of it. The Bodhisattva takes on an incomprehensible task. Right? Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Really? Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are endless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. All delusions are ended, all beings are saved, every opportunity for practice, every Dharma gate is entered and fulfilled, and I'm completely realized Buddha's way in every moment. Now, what do you think the chances are? I mean, how do we actually believe that we can do that? You know, we can do that. But that's part of the kind of trick of the Bodhisattva vow. Is that it points us to really understanding who we are, that we as an isolated, separate being cannot do that on our own. You know? We can't, you know, are we going to run around to every being, even every being in Santa Cruz, and say, what do you need? Can I help you? Can I help you? What do you need? What do you need? What do you need? Think about it. We would become exhausted and depressed if we believed that we alone were the ones that needed to do that. It would be an endless series of hopeless tasks. So the Bodhisattva vow can only be a way of liberation, a way of joy and engagement, if we look deeply at the teachings of emptiness and Buddha nature and dependent co-arising and say, oh, right, I am Buddha nature. I am dependent co-arising. I'm a part of everything. I'm not the center of the universe. This is one of the toxic sides of thinking that you're center of the universe, is that if you take on something like the Bodhisattva vow, then it becomes overwhelming, Herculean, and depressing. Right? But if you remember, oh, I'm a part of all this. That's who I am fundamentally. Is fundamentally, I am this whole universe. I am this. So the I that's living out the Bodhisattva vow is much more than my own separate little self. As a cell of the universe, a Japanese teacher named Aoyama Roshi, woman Roshi, says we are the cells of the universe. So if we are a cell of the universe and we take on the Bodhisattva vow, it's a completely different story. We can joyfully enter the world and do what we can in our lives to liberate beings, to enter every practice gate, to end delusions as a part of the the overall sense of the Bodhisattva vow. Does that make sense? It's very important that we remember this, because the potential for burnout is great. And so if we see it as something we have to do, we either burn out, get depressed, or give up. And that's not the Bodhisattva way. The Bodhisattva way is not grim. It's joyful. So these are some of the important things to remember about the Bodhisattva vow. When we wake up to this vow, it's said that great compassion takes hold of us. Great compassion takes hold of us. That great compassion is Canon's hearing the cries of the world. That great compassion is for us too. We participate with all beings in this dependent co-arising. So we, you know, wisdom and compassion go together then. When we see clearly, which is wisdom, that we and all beings are interrelated, compassion opens up in us because we're not separating ourselves. And when we cultivate compassion, we taste intimacy and care, we see more clearly, right? So there's no escaping. And we're supported by wisdom and compassion are often called the two wings of a bird. I say without both of them, you fly around in circles, right? So you need to cultivate seeing clearly, which is one of the reasons that we sit zazen. We take care of ourselves. We take care of our lives. So we can see clearly. If we're exhausted, we're overwhelmed, we're burnt out, we can't see clearly. Let's say, I need to take a break now. I need to take a walk now. I need to eat right. I need to take care of myself so I can see clearly. And when we see clearly, our heart opens and we feel a desire to participate in responding to the cries of the world. And in that we enact compassion. And not just compassion for other people. The circle of compassion is not stop with us. It includes us. This is what we call the dignified activity of a Buddha. Right? So this great compassion and wisdom arise together, and they're expressed in the third of the tripod, which is skillful means. If we see clearly, we're balanced, our heart is open, we have a much better chance of acting with skill. Because, you know, we can have what we think is great compassion and go blundering into situations and do all the wrong things. In fact, as human beings, that's a lot what we do, right? We say stupid things, we do stupid things. We may think we're being kind, but we're actually making a mess. So we cultivate clarity so that we don't just blunder along. And we cultivate compassion so that we want to respond. And in that, we express skillful means. So this arises from the ground of our interconnected reality. This is thusness in action. This is us expressing most deeply who we are. So this path calls us. This path calls us to live out what is most true. Dogen teaches us. I want to read you a little, more than a little quote, but I think it quite beautifully expresses this. So Dogen was the founder of our school. And he wrote many beautiful things, some of them pretty easy to understand, and other of them, I mean, it just takes a lifetime of living with them to get a feel. This is one of the ones that's a little more clear. Easily clear. So, he says, working for the welfare of all beings means that you contrive ways to benefit all sentient beings, high and low. In other words, you carefully investigate others' distant and near futures and think of the various means which will be the most congenial to their well-being. Commiserate with the turtle in trouble and take care of the sparrow suffering from injury. When you see the distressed turtle or watch the sick sparrow, you do not expect repayment for your favor, but you are moved entirely by your desire to help others. Fools may think that if another's benefit is given priority, their own good must be lost. This is not the case. The practice of benefiting others is the total truth. Hence, it serves both self and others far and wide. Therefore, serve enemies and friends equally, and assist self and others without discrimination. If you grasp this truth, you will see that this is the reason that even grasses and trees, the wind and water, are all naturally engaged in the activity of profiting others. And your understanding will certainly serve others' benefit. Isn't that beautiful? He's talking about living a life of benefiting others and oneself from the point of view of seeing clearly who we are and who others are, and living from that with skillful means. So when we see clearly, when we don't see clearly, we might imagine that if we give another's benefit priority, that our own is diminished or lost. And he tells us this is not the case. When we practice, when we live a life of practice of benefiting others, this is the total truth. And it serves us and others far and wide. One of the things that struck me about the story about this man who was liberated from the concentration camp was that he went on to live a life of service, and in part it was due to this one act of kindness that countered all that he had experienced of the great evil that we can perpetrate on one another as human beings. That moment of kindness, that moment of care, brought to the fore a different reality. And this is what we can do all the times in our lives. We can act in this way. So this serves ourselves and others. Therefore, serve enemies and friends equally. Assist self and others without discrimination. I like to emphasize this because often you can think of others exclusively and forget about yourself, and that does not work. And he points out that it's not just human beings that are doing this. Grasses and trees and wind and water are all engaged in profiting others. That means that this dependent horizon, we are always giving to others, and we are always being given to. Every breath we take is given to us, isn't it? We don't think about it. We don't make it happen. But it's just freely given. Amazing. The 8th century Buddhist philosopher and teacher Shantideva wrote a text called The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way. And one of the stanzas in that is, he says, may I be a protector for those without one, a guide for travelers on the way, May I be a bridge, a boat, and a ship for all those who wish to cross the water. May I be an island for those who seek one and a lamp for those desiring light. May I be a bed for those who wish to rest. Just like space and all the great elements such as earth that support life for all the realms of the varied beings that reach unto the ends of space. So he's describing the path of practice here, path of realization. He calls it the supreme ambrosia, the supreme medicine. He calls it the tree that shelters all beings and the universal bridge. In another stanza, he says, for all those guests traveling on the path of conditioned existence, which is our lives, who wish to experience the boundlessness, the bounties of happiness, this will satisfy them with joy and actually place them in supreme bliss. So the thing I want to emphasize about this last statement is he's not saying you will, if you get all this right in the end, you will have joy or bliss. He's saying if you practice this vow, you will have joy, right? So it's not in a hypothetical future when all beings are saved that you finally get to have joy or happiness. Like, oh, fine. You know that thing of endless work? Anybody ever have that? You know, it's like, I'll rest when I get everything done. And then the to-do list, just like, so you have on your Bodhisattva to-do list, save all beings. Enter all Dharma gates. Okay, I got the to-do list now. If I just work really, really hard and I get all that done, all beings are saved, now I can. He's not saying that. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, if you practice this vow, this is joy. You don't have to wait till your to-do list is done. That it doesn't work that way. The way it works is by taking this vow, by taking this and placing this practice in the center of your life, you will experience joy. It doesn't mean that you won't hurt and struggle and have suffering and, you know, look at what's going on in the world and just feel like, ah, heartbreak. It doesn't mean that. But it means in the midst of that, in the midst of the life that we have, we will experience joy. We will experience satisfaction. We'll experience a life that has meaning and beauty. Because that's where our joy, real joy comes from, isn't it? When we live that life that we feel called to live. When we're in connection with others. When we're of service to others. And we care for ourselves out of respect and dignity. Not as an afterthought. So this way of living opens up a possibility of meaning and joy and engagement and strength with others. This is humility as well, right? We're not setting ourselves up as, you know, Buddha's gift to the world, except we are, along with everybody else. But we're in this. I like to call bodhisattvas members of the Bodhisattva Union. You know? We're all members of the Bodhisattva Union, working shoulder to shoulder with all beings to alleviate suffering and cultivate joy and meaning and beauty in our lives. So there's a great kinship, sense of kinship as a bodhisattva. And you know, bodhisattvas don't have to be Buddhists, that's for sure. You know, we have a sense of affinity and kinship with all others, no matter what. But in particular, we feel ourselves shoulder to shoulder with others who are working to live a life of meaning and beauty and service. So another aspect of this is that individual liberation is a contradiction in terms. If we think we alone are going to find liberation without others, we are making the fundamental mistake of thinking that we're separate from others, right? It's in diving into that connection that we really find what true liberation is. And it might not look like what you think. Usually we think of liberation as, like, I finally get to put my feet up and everything's comfortable and, you know, the temperature's just right and, you know, but, you know, I'll be all-knowing, I'll know what to do, when, I'll be, right? You know, we have this fantasy that that's what it's going to be. But liberation, according to our tradition, is living that life with other beings in which we engage in the Bodhisattva vow and we're connected to all. And it happens each moment. Every moment is a possibility. Every moment we can live this out. Every moment is realization. So in the same way that Shantideva says that a life of joy and a life of beauty in that way is living out the vow, not what happens after you've done everything right. One of the teachings that Dogen teaches is called practice realization, which means that each moment of practice is realization. We don't practice in order that something happens later on. In our practice, in this moment, when we're kind to another being, when we care for our environment, when we don't say the sharp word to another as it's like ready to pop out like a toad, when we do these things, that is realization in that moment. That is the living of the Bodhisattva vow. That is where we find meaning and joy and beauty. That moment, and the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment. And as he says, you know, one moment of practice is one moment of realization, and it is true whether this is the first time you ever even occurred to you to practice, or the 30 millionth time. That turning towards reality is the realization of the Buddha way. And it is absolutely open to you any moment, anywhere. The practice is totally portable. You don't have to be anything different. You don't have to dress up in a certain way. You don't have to do anything other than to bring your heart and mind to it. And we have practices, which I'm going to talk about in more detail next week, that are touchstones, foundations, supports. Zazen is the most central of those, right? But you don't have to twist yourself into a pretzel to sit full lotus. You can do it on a chair. You can do it standing. You can do it anywhere. So it's really, really important that we take responsibility for our own practice and say, yep, me, this one. I don't have to be some other one. I don't have to shave my head and go to a monastery. It's totally available to me right now. And it's, reflect on the Bodhisattva vow. Reflect on what is your deepest values? What is your deepest intention? What do you want to do with this precious life, as Mary Oliver says? And to really untangle that from oppressive, I have to be a certain way, or I have to save all beings, or it doesn't count, or whatever. But really open up the Bodhisattva way in your life, at the grocery store, when you're driving, or riding your bike, or you know, when you're washing dishes. And consider how you support a life of practice in that way. And, yeah, I think that's enough for now. Thank you.